Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The semi-rigorously enforced two guests in two segments format prevails once again today. A break, though, from all the dispiriting news of genocidal war and incipient fascism. Some ideas for a post-capitalist future from Aaron Beninoff, and live possibilities in the present, the cooperative form, outlined by Jerome Nikolai Warren. We'll return to the gloomscape soon, but I need a rest. Many of us on the left, and I certainly number myself among them, are more comfortable standing back and kvetching instead of constructively thinking about a better future. Both my guests today are doing the constructive thing, and I'm importing some optimism from them. First, Aaron Beninoff, who has the first of a two-part look at a post-capitalist future in the May-June issue of New Left Review. The subtitle, Groundwork for a Multi-Criterial Economy, doesn't exactly flow off the tongue, but what he's saying with it is incontrovertible. Any future economic system, any utopia we're working towards in the present, has to meet a lot of needs. Among them, material welfare, ecological sustainability, and support for human flourishing. Capitalism does none of these things and often undermines them. One of the crucial issues for any transformative politics is rethinking investment, that is, the decisions that shape the physical infrastructure of society, the apparatus of production and distribution. Some of that is done by the public sector in capitalist society, transportation, schools, R&D, but most of it is done by a relative handful of people motivated by profit, a consideration that also has influence in the public sector. Collective social needs do not enter into their calculations, and most people are excluded from having a voice in how those decisions are made. Aaron Beninoff, an assistant professor of sociology at Cornell, has some better ideas. Needless to say, they're not in the current agenda of American politics, but it sure would be nice to get them there. Here's a start. Aaron Beninoff. In the depths of Trumpy gloom, it can seem fanciful to think about what comes after capitalism, given the challenges of just getting by. But this kind of thinking, perhaps a way of coping with a terrible present?
When I started working on this project, it was really the end of the 2010s, which was a period that saw incredible rise from the ashes of social struggles and political movements around the world. And it felt really important to think about what it might mean to win and to revive and revise also our visions of a better future to suit the times that we lived in. Between 2020 and now, I have to admit, in the past few years, it's really become a way for me to kind of like take flight into the imagination and take a break from all of the terrible things that seem to be not just happening around the world, but getting a lot worse every day.
Well, yeah, a lot of people on the socialist left have been, or the left more broadly, have been very reluctant to talk about what a future society would look like. I mean, there's that line that got popular in the 80s and 90s that, you know, there's just several short steps to the gulag from that kind of ambitious thinking. It's really good to get away from that constraint and start thinking in somewhat utopian fashion again.
I guess my view as I went deeper into this project was that in some ways our pessimism about the future and pessimism about the socialist projects of the past is a way of maybe dealing with the fact that we don't have any idea what a positive future would look like anymore. I mean, we have the outlines. We know what it should do for people, right? Like, we know that we want to live in a world where people feel really secure in their financial and material survival, that we want to live in a world that's more ecologically sustainable, that meets all of these feminist and anti-racist goals. Like, we could start laying out the objectives that we think such a world should meet. But the idea of how to actually do that has become so unclear to us. And I think it's something that really separates us from the socialists of 100 or even 150 years ago. I mean, they faced really dire political and social situations and, you know, lived through massive counter-revolutions and reactionary decades. But I think that in a way, especially at the end of the 19th and start of the 20th century, they had this really clear idea of what they were fighting for. And I think for a very long time, we've been laboring without that.
We're not looking in this imaginable future to maximize per capita GDP, right? That's not our goal.
I guess the way that I would say it is that that's one goal, that it's a totally reasonable goal to think that we should both make existing production processes more efficient and also to invent new products, right? Like, those are totally worthwhile goals. My point is that we need to sort of see that as one goal among many and think about how to balance all of the different goals that we have. And a lot of what I'm writing about is about the limits of technical forms of reasoning to kind of achieve that balance for us. Some people talk about how in the 20th century or in the mid-20th century, this idea that the economy is really about growing people's incomes is a way to depoliticize the economy. Often they meant in distributional terms, right? That if the pie is growing for everyone, then workers will be less concerned about what their share is of the pie and inequality will be less important. But what I'm talking about is something else, which is this idea that the focus on GDP growth also depoliticizes production and what the goals are of our economy and of our production, and that those are things we're going to have to open up, especially dealing with the climate crisis, but also with all of these other things that we want from the economy.
There's been a neglect of thinking about production on the left. A lot of thought about consumption, much less so about production, it seems.
Because thinking about production requires thinking about what actually is or could be the economy of the future. If you focus on distribution, then, you know, you can kind of imagine the engine of the system remaining more or less the same, but using its fruits in different ways. And of course, you know, my last book was about automation and what I called the automation discourse, which was this whole set of fantasies. Efficiency and productivity were about to grow by such enormous leaps and bounds that the only question left for us to answer would be a distributional question.
And now there's AI, right?
Yeah, supposedly.
Yes, right. Soviet experience, now almost universally despised, really does have some features worth revisiting or thinking about again. Notably, the role of a coordinated planned investment in promoting economic and social development. How much is worth retrieving from that experience? What can we learn from it?
Whenever you talk about the Soviet Union, it's really important to say that it was a social, political, and arguably also environmental disaster. There's no heroic sense of that period that we should be reviving. But that isn't to say that in the mess, there weren't really important lessons for us that are both negative and positive. But if we were going to focus on the positive lessons, I would say that what was fascinating about the Soviet Union was their discovery in practice of five-year plans, which is what you were just talking about, this idea of coordinated, massively coordinated investment. Some of the reasons why that is so important is just that we live in a much more technologically advanced economy, that where a lot of different production processes are dependent on, they only become viable when they operate at enormous scales. And the Soviet Union discovered that by planning investment really in advance, instead of having to kind of grope our way slowly towards achieving those scales, we could just fix our eyes on the goal and just build our way there, build all of these industries simultaneously that needed to work together in order to be viable at all, and just build them towards that scale in time. And of course, it wasn't just Soviet Union, it was then countries like Japan and South Korea and eventually China that took on this model of dynamic five-year planning to build huge industries and achieve, for those that are operating in the capitalist world, incredible dynamic competitiveness in a rather short period of time.
Now, of course, the planning mechanism was brutally criticized by Mises and Hayek. Planning is too static. Markets are dynamic and evolutionary. It's really hard to learn from mistakes. Now, looking at all the homogenous crap that capitalism is producing these days makes you wonder. But you know, this critique does have a point. How do you address that in some reinvigoration of the idea of planning?
Well, I think I take those critiques really seriously. And in a way, it's more about incorporating them as ideas than counteracting them. So there's a lot of people looking at planning today, and not just socialists. He's disappeared mostly from the public eye. Maybe he's back a little bit. But Jack Ma, the Chinese businessman, he had this idea that with big data, we might be able to like revive the planning apparatus. And there's many other people who think that we just have so much knowledge now that we can like kind of draw out of the economy with digital tools that we don't really have to worry about the kinds of problems that Mises and Hayek focused on, which had to do with this idea that the economy is just too complex to be able to plan from a single central node. But I think that they were right, and that the kind of complexity they were talking about is not the complexity of all the calculations involved. It's much more a theory of the complexity of the division of knowledge and division of labor. Basically, like Marx really thought that over time, there would be this convergence in the way we all work, that we'd all become interchangeable semi-skilled laborers. And it's obviously true that a lot of work has been de-skilled and a lot of kinds of jobs are now maybe more interchangeable than they were in Marx's time. But that only accounts for a portion of the workforce. All of these other jobs have become incredibly complexly specified, whether you're dealing with different forms of engineering or work in healthcare or within healthcare, work in like vaccines or in other parts of the system. There's all of these really specific forms of knowledge that you need on the ground, not just in order to know what to do in the moment, but also, as you were saying, for on-the-ground dynamism and adaptation, both when things don't go as planned, but also in order to innovate on the ground. And I think that, you know, in a weird way, to some people on the left, these ideas that Hayek and Mises have their own appeal. Hayek is obviously thinking much more about entrepreneurs and, you know, his models, maybe also Schumpeter or something, about some kind of heroic businessman like Steve Jobs or whatever, or Elon Musk today. But from another perspective, it's really a theory about the need for the local and specific knowledge that workers have, right? That average everyday working people have of their conditions of work and of what to do and how to modify and change those conditions for the better. There's a lot there that actually we should draw on as we think about a better future society.
Under capitalism, firms launch a product into the market, and the product either sells well or it flops, and then adjustments are made after the fact. Is there a way to do that under a more planned system? How are you thinking about that?
The thing about the Soviet Union is that they were able to achieve this incredible dynamic growth with the five-year plans, but over time, what might be called, or what some call, static inefficiencies really became overwhelming. There was just a huge amount of waste in the system, and it wasn't just waste. There were shortages, and then there was hoarding in response to shortages. Producers felt that they had to lie about what they were producing and what they needed in order to acquire resources so they could get other resources on the black market. It became a huge mess. And in the 1960s, Hungary, but also then other Eastern European countries, started to introduce markets. They were already black markets, of course. Like, they were never actually able to eliminate markets, but they allowed for legal markets to organize production. And it did result in a big gain in terms of these static efficiencies. It didn't really redynamize the system, because a lot of these Soviet and Eastern Bloc countries were starting to see much lower rates of growth in the 60s and then stagnation in the 70s and onwards. It did make the system work a little bit better. That had a huge influence. We could talk about different kinds of market socialists. It also maybe had an influence on what happened in China and the kind of reform paths that they took. But in general, I think there was this idea, especially in the East Asian way of taking over the five-year plans, that it's better to pair this kind of dynamic, politicized investment process from above with a much more marketized way of handling day-to-day interactions and flows throughout the economy, that really, in order to have a viable economy, producers on the ground need to be the ones deciding which suppliers they want to draw from, what kinds of products they want to bring to market, that you need a lot more autonomy on the ground. And the question that we have to face, if we're thinking about, okay, the results of all of the mess of the 20th century, especially when it comes to socialism, is in part, like, what is the role of markets going to be in a planned economy, and what remains of a role for planning? You have people drawing on John Romer's model of socialism, which really abandons most ideas about planning altogether and tries to imagine just a highly marketized system that solves capitalism's distributional problems, eliminates the capitalist class, and creates a more egalitarian capitalist society. And in my view, it's really important to think about here, you know, to return to something we talked about earlier, to think about the goals of this society. What actually do we want this society to do? And what are the limits of a capitalist economy in actually meeting those goals? And this is where I kind of get into this idea of a multi-dimensional or multi-criterial economy.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Aaron Beninoff. To continue an earlier point, a just economic system shouldn't just be about producing stuff efficiently. Its values should be more than economic. Planning isn't just a technical issue. So what would those values be, and how could they be incorporated into your planning idea?
So this is always a little bit of a difficult point for me, because in order to talk about it, I have to talk about the kinds of values that would come into it. And some of them are really obvious. I think the most obvious ones that I frequently return to are a world where we really aren't just maximizing what we produce, but also ensuring that people have real security and aren't worried about their survival, which is incredibly important for opening up people's lives and futures, being environmentally sustainable, which is itself a kind of composite value that includes many subcategories of different aspects of sustainability. Also, improving the quality of work and actually making sure that the work people do is something that not just uses their skills, but also their intelligences and involves them in the process of managing their own work. And then, you know, rebuilding communities and preserving autonomy and increasing democracy. Like, the list of values can really go on. One thing that I find very interesting about the present moment, we talked about ESG and ethical investing and ethical consumption before. There's also been this really big beyond GDP movement at the UN and at the OECD, where they're trying to think about, okay, well, what are the actual categories of well-being? And they come up with a bunch of different ones. They're often based on the work of this Indian economist, Amartya Sen, and his former partner, Martha Nussbaum, this capabilities approach. As I see it, one of the big problems with these approaches is that they're values-first approaches. So they start from the idea that we should like get together and decide all the values that matter to us, and then begin to implement them in the economy. And I think it's very important to have a value-based, or I should say, a values-based economy, but it's really impossible to do it in that way, because the truth is that our values are things that both matter to us a lot and differ very substantially from person to person and community to community. And they have to, in my view, remain really big objects of social and political contention, rather than thinking that we can set them all out first and then begin to integrate them into the economy. We need something much more dynamic that allows our values to shape what we're doing economically, and also for our values to change as we participate in economic processes and come to understand what's important to us.
Yeah, you say planning was usually not seen as an arena for the articulation of disagreements, but as a way to put an end to them. There was this general belief that socialism would somehow put an end to social conflict, which now seems hopelessly naive. That's not going to go away, is it?
It was hopelessly naive. And I think, you know, when you read socialist thinkers from the past, I would say that the most utopian dimension of their thinking about planning was just that, that they thought that once you overcome class divisions, you'll overcome all of the fundamental divisions of society. And at that point, we can just, every question is just a technical question, you know? There might be better or worse answers, but if we get the experts together, and maybe that's everyone, then we should be able to figure it out. And the idea that there would just be these huge differences in the kinds of worlds that people want to build and what matters to them, what their priorities are. To me, the place you see it most is in the debates and conflicts that emerged within the socialist movement around anti-racism and feminist struggles, where there was a real difficulty recognizing and incorporating those movements, not only because of the way this is normally discussed, which is like, who's the subject of history and, you know, what role do non-class identities have in socialist politics, but much more about how these struggles raise really important questions about the values of socialism around autonomy and community and care, and eventually later with the environmental movement, sustainability, recognizing how political our debates will be about those priorities well after the end of capitalism. That's something that I want to focus on. And then I think, yeah, was maybe one of the major reasons why socialists in the past had a lot of trouble. Even where they saw the need to integrate many values, the fact that integrating many values would itself generate a lot of conflicts was a kind of conclusion they shied away from.
Now, you turned to Keynes for guidance on the investment issue, the socialization of investment. And his comments on this often seem more evocative than detailed. What do you draw from him?
Yeah, like Keynes is a really important thinker. I think that like Marx, there's this way that some of the insights of the master are sort of buried and reconfigured by the students and have to be unearthed much later. And in my reading of Keynes, I draw a lot from someone who died a few years ago, James Crotty, who wrote this book, Keynes Against Capitalism, that I highly recommend. You know, although I'm critical of it, because he has this way of blurring the distinction between liberal socialism, which is the term that Keynes uses to describe his own thinking, and democratic socialism, which I think is maybe something else. But I think that's a really important touchstone text. But essentially, I think Keynes was a socialist.
He's also deeply elitist, though, which doesn't really fit with your democratic vision.
I'm sorry, but a lot of socialists have been elitist in the 20th century. That's what I'm saying. It's not a democratic socialist vision by any means, but it is a very technocratic vision. And that, I think technocratic visions of socialism are just dominant in the 20th century. But yeah, I think Keynes was trying to imagine a world without profit rates and without interest rates. And he was trying to imagine how you could coordinate investment in a society that was no longer fundamentally dynamically motivated by profit. And what was most important to me is that he theorized how you get there. And this is where I think what you said about how he made these evocative comments but didn't really fill it out. I think this is just an unfortunate biographical fact that he died right as World War II was coming to an end, because what I end up drawing on a lot are his letters from the war period, where he was writing quite a lot about what he imagined a post-war order should look like. And what I find very interesting about this is that Keynes is obviously associated with this idea of counter-cyclical spending as a way to smooth the business cycle. And there's letters where James Meade is just proposing all of this to him, saying, hey, what if we have all these automatic mechanisms that stabilize the economy in the event of a downturn, like unemployment insurance? And Keynes is just like, that will never work. That's not what I'm about at all. What I'm about is like public investment, public control over investment, and not in the way that it was sometimes thought about in the post-war era, like public investment varying to kind of fill the gaps in private investment, but rather this model, which I think hasn't been examined, at least recently, in much detail, but Jim Crotty does talk about it. And this isn't what I'm advocating, but I think it's an important idea from Keynes that the vast majority of investment should be public. And there should just be a remainder of public investment. And in his model, the small remainder of private investment, the state can veto that if it needs to for its purposes. So it's really a model of like total public control over investment that I think hasn't been well examined. But this one thinker, very important person, William Beveridge, who invented the idea of like the cradle to grave welfare state and the NHS, after he developed the NHS, he wrote this book called Full Employment in a Free Society, and it's a fully worked out institutional model of how, as a Keynesian, as a radical Keynesian, you would try to transition out of capitalism. Again, I'm actually quite critical of Keynesians and very critical of the technocratic conception that they have, but in this idea of a national investment board and the way they theorize how that board would function within the wider economy, I think there's a lot we have to learn.
Okay, so you talk about a multi-criterial approach. We don't want more profit. We don't want just more stuff. But what are you thinking of with this multi-criterial approach? Was it what you were talking about earlier with like the various values that we need to sort out?
Essentially, what it means is that once you have this idea that the goal in organizing production is to meet many different goals, that has consequences at every level of the economy. So when it comes to the highest level, which is like what we started off talking about, investment planning, five-year plans, and all that kind of stuff, having multiple goals means there's no single best direction for progress to go in into the future. There's different possible futures that we can move towards, which will combine and enliven our values in different ways. But for precisely that reason, there's a really important dimension of political choice. Once you no longer think the economy is just about raising GDP, you're going to enter a much more open space of progress, right, where there's many different ways we can go. And that then ramifies down to all of these different levels. So even at the realm of individual production unit, whether you're talking about a firm that's like a cooperative or however it's organized, like if that firm is trying to maximize output, desired output from its inputs, but also to produce good quality work and to produce in an environmentally sustainable way and to integrate, you know, in the community in all these different ways. What it means is there's no longer going to be an economically optimal method of production anymore. And even when it comes to households, like households aren't just utility maximizing in some simple sense of trying to get as many goods and services as they can. Households have many different goals in the choices they make around organizing their activity. And so the idea is to kind of rethink economics at all these different levels, where what economic reasoning allows us to do is something like eliminate bad options, right? There's many ways to produce that would be less good. We want to organize the economy in a way that reveals the best trade-offs that we can make. If we want to be as efficient as possible, but also as sustainable as possible, there's going to be some point where increasing sustainability is going to come at the cost of increased efficiency. And what we want to do is we want to have an economic model that in some way is presenting us with the best possible versions of that trade-off. And so, yeah, that's kind of the theory of it, is that you want an economic system that does these things. And it turns out that markets are actually really useful for that in a lot of ways that neither socialists nor liberal proponents of capitalism, I think, were very clear about. When you're doing that, it's going to be very political. Like, which trade-offs you choose, which futures you walk toward is going to be a very political question.
This would require lots of deliberation. And I was reminded of a comment that Nancy Fulbright once made to me about the Hanel and Albert participatory economy. And she said it was a vision of life like one long student council meeting.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
It is a problem. And that's why, you know, I mean, I think that Albert and Hanel's Paracon was a really brilliant theory and built on that Longo Lerner Taylor model that came out of the socialist calculation debate. But I think, I'm not only critical of it because of the too many meetings problem, but I think part of the reason to have a recourse to markets, which I do, although in this highly modified form that I spell out in the second part that hasn't been published yet, is that they allow us to like coordinate without as much discussion. To me, what matters is you're working at a t-shirt company in a social society, and you have your own internal debates about how to balance these different goals that matter to the people who work there and that matter to society. But those are really important also for like motivating you and understanding what matters about your work, what's at stake in it. We want to have the debates that matter, and we don't want to engage in a complete society-wide discussion to determine equilibrium balance among like all the different branches of production. Yeah, it's very much a theory about where are the actual places where we want to have discussion and what can be left to people's autonomous decisions. I think that's a very important point.
There is Aaron Belenoff, an assistant professor of sociology at Cornell and author of a two-part series, Beyond Capitalism, in New Left Review. The first part is in the May-June issue. The second is forthcoming. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Maximum Consumption by the Kinks from their 1972 album, Everybody's in Showbiz. Next, a look at cooperatives with an emphasis on Italy. I must confess to some ambivalence about co-ops. While they certainly can improve life for their members, they don't easily address the broad problems of investment at the society-wide level. I'll leave aside the too many meetings problem for now. But as we'll hear, they do have some possibilities for shaping investment, and the deliberative culture they foster can have a positive influence on society. Here with more is Jerome Nicolai Warren. He's a research fellow at the University of Cologne, which he indulgently freed me from calling the best-smelling university in the world. He's also on the board of the Evolution Institute, a foundation based in Florida, aimed at bringing science-based approaches towards community regeneration and strengthening of democratic and pro-social practices. Jerome Nicolai Warren. Co-ops have a long history in Italy. They go back into the 19th century. Could you tell us how they got started?
Before answering that question, a little different question that people usually ask when they think about co-ops is why are there so few? And usually they answer that question saying there's some kind of internal deficit. Co-ops are all, you know, sitting around the campfire, and that's why there aren't so many of them, because, you know, capitalist enterprises are more efficient and so on and so on. The case of Italy is a very clear counterexample. When the conditions are right, co-ops can indeed flourish, and they can be in most sectors. Italy began as a quite normal country in terms of its co-op development in the middle of the 19th century, about the same time as the Rochdale pioneers around Manchester and other examples in Germany and so on. So you had mostly rural development that was happening via cooperatives. You had, on the one hand, Catholics that saw cooperatives, especially after the 1880s, 1890s, as a tool for removing impoverishment or eliminating impoverishment and creating a kind of community, brethrenship, this kind of thing. You had the socialist communists who, of course, had a very different take on cooperatives. They saw them directly as a means to create basically a form of socialism within the existing order. And then you had this third interesting group of liberal nationalists, basically. These are people like Giuseppe Mazzini, one of the founders of modern Italy, who people have difficulty putting him in a category. There's actually even some who say there's a kind of Mazzinian socialism. So they saw a very different reason as cooperatives being a kind of harmonic a convergence of capital and labor in one hand. So basically around this time of the middle of the 19th century to the end of the 19th century, you had these three different groups who coalesced around the cooperative form, and they promoted it as a means to rural and then later urban development.
With another Leo in the news, how did Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum affect the development of co-ops?
The Catholics did really get behind cooperative development about this time, 1880s, 1890s, there were a few outliers there. There were two in particular that did emerge at this time, Catholic priests, local priests who were advocating for the cooperatives as a form of development. There was a kind of a divergence in what was going on in the local parishes and in the center in Rome. So basically you had these kind of rebels that were creating what they called family shops or family enterprises, promoting a form of direct participation of the local parish. Rome basically saw what was happening. They saw the emergence of the socialist movement and got behind these radical priests and supported them. And this was the promulgation that resulted in Leo XIII writing Rerum Novarum, and basically saying, well, you know, we shouldn't leave all this development to the socialists. We should also get involved and create a cooperative ecosystem.
And how did they do under Mussolini?
He was very aggressive in his attempts to co-opt the movement, rendering it subservient to his ends. He immediately put the screws on the co-ops, which immediately resisted efforts, for instance, to install functionaries in the boards and so on.
And then with the fall of Mussolini, what role did they have in the post-war economic miracle?
There was a great recognition in the immediate post-war. Fascist Italy fell in 43, so you know, even before the end of the war in 45, you had the reconstruction of Italy happening, and cooperatives actively played a role in that effort, you know, providing people with the basic necessities of life. There was a consensus in the political middle, even, that extended from the Christian Democrats all the way to the Communist Party, that cooperatives played an essential role in resisting fascism. You had some statesmen who managed to slip in to convince their colleagues immediately after the war to recognize these efforts on the part of cooperatives in the post-war constitution. So one of the most interesting things is Article 45 of the Italian Constitution that promotes cooperatives, seeing them as a non-speculative entrepreneurial form that acts in the public interest, and it acts to protect actually this non-speculative, so to speak, pro-social activity.
Now, it certainly helped their development that they had a productive relationship with the political structures, right, the parties in the state.
Yes, and my good friend Piero Amirato has a term that he uses, the cooperative development model, to describe this post-war regime and similar regimes in other countries. You could talk about, you know, in the Basque region in Spain. So, yes, the cooperative development model that emerged in Italy is very much characterized by a alliance between the unions, especially left-leaning union. You also have, you know, the Catholic Union, as with all things in Italy, and then the party, the PCI, the Communist Party, and the cooperatives were basically working in tandem to promote growth and provide jobs and, in fact, in many ways, in principal industries. So in different regions in Italy, of course, in the post-war environment, you had majorities for the communists, which, you know, at certain times was the largest party in Italy in the parliament. But, of course, you know, there was a basically boycott from other, you know, centrist parties like the Christian Democrats. They just would not govern with the communists at the national level. But the communists did manage to, you know, have an impact in places like Emilia-Romagna,
and in Tuscany and in Umbria, and basically had this kind of development model there. So to this day, you really have very strong presence of co-ops in these provinces, especially Emilia-Romagna. I believe it's still about one third of the economy that is cooperative there. And in some cities, literally everybody works in a co-op, like Imola, which is like 40 kilometers from Bologna. Basically, six, seven of the largest co-ops in Italy are all located there.
They engage in a variety of activities. There's a mix of productive economic agents, but also social benefit organizations. So how's that that mix work out?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon in how that actually evolved or emerged. And in many ways, the foundation of the Italian co-op ecosystem is industrial cooperatives, large-scale worker cooperatives like the ones I just mentioned, ones like SACMI, which has a revenue of over €1 billion a year. So it's really a behemoth, multinational. This is in many ways the financial backbone, but through the decades, and especially after the kind of political crisis and the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, the co-ops realized, and even before then, that they needed to kind of change their model and go to where people are and have a more present role in people's day-to-day lives, not just, be in their factories and pay taxes and maybe do some corporate social responsibility. So really around the 80s and through the 90s, this model emerged of social enterprises and based on cooperatives in many ways. So you had the social cooperatives that were dealing with mental health and other integration.
The mental health angle is very important, right? They're very influential in the transformation of the treatment of mental illness in Italy.
Yes, and even beyond. I mean, this is something where I think Italians can be very proud. And I talked, I work with Italians myself, and for them, it's, we have co-ops, whatever, So it's just for them something, every day. But they really should be proud because this is a really fascinating tradition in history. And there is this great book by Verso, by John Foote, the man who closed the asylums, on the role that Franco Basaglia, for instance, in particular, played in the emergence of these social cooperatives. In Trieste, you had the first social cooperative in history. I think it was founded in the 70s, 72, 74. It's like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. You have, in many ways, the liberation of patients in a mental asylum who are made, to, through their kind of entrepreneurial activity, to be autonomous. So they were tasked with basically with cleaning the wards. And Basaglia basically said, we're not going to subsidize you. You have to be independent. You need to be, integrated into the society. And this was kind of the birth era of the social cooperative, which then really rapidly moved to take on new tasks. They started in mental health provision, this kind of a multi-stakeholder model where the municipality, families in the community, and even patients have an ownership stake in the provision of care. And people realized immediately how useful this is in other domains. So it quickly mutated from there. And, you have after-school care, you have integration services for migrants. And then most recently now, you have the emergence of community cooperatives, which are basically self-organized community enterprises where people in rural regions say, we don't want more young people moving away, and we need to organize ourselves to take care of a local park, to install solar panels, to, so they're basically, these are people who are, the market and the state have failed, who are able to harness the cooperative form to self-organize and engage in some form of local development.
Now, they are also economic actors, produce, 8% of Italian GDP, I think you said, active job creators. So what do they do? What sectors are they active in?
I mean, this is the interesting thing about Italy and what distinguishes it from other countries. Again, I live in Germany, so here we have quite large cooperative banks that take about one-fourth of the banking sector. In this country, we have housing cooperatives, some agricultural and some energy co-ops. Italy has a cooperative system that is in every sector. You have construction cooperatives, you have dentist cooperatives, you have anything that you can think of. The largest supermarket chain in Italy is a consumer cooperative that's associated with the Socialist Communist Federation, and so on. So they're doing anything that you can think of. There are architectural co-ops. One of the more interesting projects that I know of is a consortium, and this is also something that Italy has focused on, is this interaction between co-ops. So they're not isolated somewhere out in the green pasture, but they are part of and embedded in federations that are acting in common. They even have their own investment fund and so on. But this project I mentioned is called Libera Terra, what they have done is to interact with the state that is reappropriating land that the mafia has been using in illicit ways. And they take this land in the south of Italy, largely, like in Sicily and Calabria, and they give it to local unemployed people to till the land and create produce that's then sold as organic produce in this large consumer cooperative. So they're literally helping to weaken the mafia. They're promoting local development and organic farming and creating this kind of pipeline that is from, what do you say, from the earth to the plate. You know, it's a cooperative kind of a model of development, but also one of social inclusion.
I'm speaking with Jerome Nicolai Warren. Now, you tell a story of Melpignano, I guess it is, a community that was fighting a big solar installation about 15 years ago and then broadened its efforts. So tell us that story. I mean, that's not the kind of thing you think of when you think of a cooperative doing.
Many co-ops are not really at the front line of a kind of social transformation and in many ways very conservative. But in this case, what happened was exactly as you say. You had a local community, part of which was more or less engaged. You had about 70 individuals who were formed the core of this group, who basically were very angry at this standardized project that was involved a national or multinational firm building this huge solar field outside of their medieval village. Which isn't to say that the locals were against solar power. They said, well, let's do it differently. You know, we have these old houses, stone houses with flat roofs. Let's do locally based photovoltaic, and we'll put it on our roofs and use it for ourselves instead of, you know, using the area here to harness the grid and sell it, you know, on the market. And so, in fact, they got in touch with the local chapter of the National Federation, the largest cooperative federation, the Lega Coop, who then basically advised them, provided them resources, provided some assistance in terms of the loan. And over time, they thought, well, in fact, we can do more than just provide ourselves with electricity. We can do other things, and got back in touch with Lega Coop. And together, they drafted a new law at the regional level and got this passed in the regional legislature to create this brand new legal form, the community cooperative, which, you know, is a new form and is based on a diffuse mutualism, because it's not a member-oriented organization where that's benefiting just its members. It's actually providing a benefit to the entire community beyond the membership, similar to but beyond an association. I talked to some of the founding members and the then president, who said basically, well, we're not an association. We're not a sports club or something, because we do have an entrepreneurial core. We want to earn money for the community that is then reinvested in different projects. So they decided to various avenues that they could enter. So one thing that they do is they clarify or purify local water. So the groundwater that's been polluted with runoff, agricultural runoff, they use the natural system of roots and minerals that they explained to me and showed me and create clean water. You get a card, a prepaid card, let's say, and you go to these houses and you bring your own water bottle and fill it up. These kind of little projects that they are able to do as a co-op to generate income and also provide value to the citizens. I mean, of course, they've since expanded to other things. They have apiaries. They provide after-school care. They have a co-working space there. They're trying to draw people back to this village, providing them, you know, resources that can promote a kind of an existence there, you know. They've gained a lot of attention internationally. Urban planners or people who are community developers, organizers, come to Melpignano, to this tiny village of 2,500 people in the south of Italy, to study this model. And it's since expanded, of course, to other villages in the area and even beyond in other parts of Italy, even in the north.
Now, if I may wax theoretical for a moment, the idea is to move from market-based transactions to something that's more longer-term relationship-based, right?
Yes.
Yeah, could you talk some more about that? How they relate to a capitalist society that's all about markets? How does this different organizational model, which is more deliberative, non-hierarchical, how does that fit into the larger society?
Well, co-ops usually do have, and most legislation that regulates co-ops includes some form of co-op internal transactions. So there are very clearly, even legally recognized, what you call cooperative contracts. And these could be things like patronage refunds. If people who are members of a cooperative buy in the co-op, they would, at the end of the year, you know, doing their books, find out how much you bought at the co-op, and you would get a discount on the basis of the profits that the co-op provided, or part of the profits.
as derivative of how much you actually purchased within the co-op. So that's something that is part of the DNA of cooperatives. I mean, that's, so to speak, from the consumer cooperative side. These kinds of cooperative contracts are part of any type of cooperative, whether it's a worker cooperative or a cooperative bank, and so on. So the point is that through this kind of democratic member control and the participatory structures that you ideally have, of course, there are co-ops that don't live up to the principles, you can actually channel benefits that a market-oriented system does not provide. So in many ways, it's similar to what Eleanor Ostrom talks about in relation to the commons. And if you read Ostrom's book, Governing the Commons, she talks about how these common resource pools, they're not a market, and they're also not a kind of rigid state hierarchy. There's something in between. They're a community that's self-governing. There's this really great tradition going back to Carol Pateman, 1970, who wrote her doctoral dissertation on what she called the spillover hypothesis, looking at the interaction between people in more democratic enterprises who have to deliberate every day and make decisions and about what they're going to do and their differential pay and so on, and their relative engagement in civic society or in political culture. And we have in our Rutledge Handbook of Cooperative Economics Management a chapter about basically the spillover hypothesis and, you know, what's happened since 1970, how has the understanding of that developed since then. This phenomenon between the kind of micro level of the enterprise and the macro society and the feedback between these two that's going on within these kinds of cooperative ecosystems is part of the reason why they provide a kind of bulwark or vaccination against emerging fascist or authoritarian tendencies. That's my own personal view, and I think that it is validated in these kinds of practices that you see in Italy and beyond.
And how do these get started? Are they like grassroots, bottom-up, top-down professional organizers? What are the modes of organization?
Particularly community cooperatives and social co-ops are a kind of model that really works best from the bottom up. There's a semi-official report on the emergence of community co-ops in Italy that was commissioned by the Ministry of Economic Development in 2016. And they review some practices that were emerging at the time on the island of Sardinia, which is the home of Gramsci, by the way. In Sardinia, they tried to promote from the top a kind of a community-based development model. They brought together community leaders from different parts of the island with some experts and did a workshop and introduced this idea, you know, we can have community co-ops. And it went nowhere. It didn't stick because the report concludes that these kinds of organizations really emerge at their best when people have faced local needs, acute needs, and they, so to speak, self-discover this model and then apply it themselves based on the kind of existing relationships that local community has. So you can't go in with a helicopter. You know, McKinsey, for instance, couldn't go in and say, you know, PowerPoint presentation, you know, oh, you have a problem here, start a community co-op. This is a kind of model that really works best. Of course, you have facilitators. As I mentioned in Melpignano, the regional office of Lega Coop really was instrumental in providing the kind of stepping stones and facilitating and catalyzing the existing resources. But I think the impetus really needs to come from local actors.
Finally, since I'm a provincial American, I have to ask this question. What can we atomized hyper-capitalist Americans learn from these Italian co-ops?
It's a good question, and my article in JEOD, the Journal for Entrepreneurial Organization Diversity, I really apply a path dependence analysis to the emergence of these kinds of organizations. And I think what that analysis shows is that these kinds of development models are possible in other places. One needs to take the necessary steps to create the preconditions. I mean, like China, perhaps, in its development model, you can skip perhaps a few steps. And taking the best examples and best practices from countries like Italy could be a means to replicate that kind of a model in other places. It is possible to recreate this model. And I think what you're seeing in the United States right now and in places like the U.S. is an acute need for local development. People feel really isolated. They feel like others have given up. The system has given up on them. And you see with the Bernie Sanders and AOC fighting oligarchy tour, you see really an acute need on the part of people. So I think part of it is providing folks with a blueprint, providing them with an idea that these kinds of development models are possible, and then actually connecting local actors. Because oftentimes I think you have ideas out there and people just feel isolated, or they feel like they're the only ones facing these problems. But I think that getting the word out there that these kinds of development models are possible is essential. Look at the community land trust that you see emerging everywhere in the world right now. I mean, we have hundreds of them in Europe. And the interesting thing is these started in Vermont, in Burlington, Vermont, and now you see them being applied in many, many other different contexts and places. So you have these kind of community-based organizations in the U.S. already. You have Cooperation Jackson, Jackson, Mississippi, like in Madison, Wisconsin. There are these kinds of models in Cleveland and in different places. So I think these models are emerging, and it's a matter of drawing attention to what's going on, sharing best practices and building up. And, of course, then anchoring these practices in legislation, like the Italian model, and having a constitutional protection, which, of course, in the given the current composition of the U.S. legislature and judiciary and executive, is not probably feasible immediately. But certainly on the local level, on the municipal level, and even perhaps on the state level, I think a lot is possible.
That was Jerome Nicolai Warren, a research fellow at the University of Cologne and a prolific author on the topic of co-ops. After we recorded this interview, Jerome messaged me to say that there are a couple of things he forgot to say in response to my question about how easy it is to form a co-op. As he noted, Italian law is very co-op friendly, which is a big help. In Italy, you only need 3 people to start a micro co-op. One of the newest approaches to forming them are worker buyouts, that is, companies converting to co-ops, usually to avoid bankruptcy. Again, that is supported by Italy's legal framework. Second thing is that in Melpignano, the solar panel-led efforts were supported by the then-mayor. Obviously, then, co-ops work better with the state on their side. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Tally Ho by The Chills. Till next week, bye.